from the Missouri School of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. In early August, Vice President Mike Pence renewed a call by the Trump administration for the U.S. military to create a space force. Now, this may call to mind sci-fi movies of men in spandex suits shooting each other with laser guns. But in some ways, this is nothing new. The U.S. Air Force Space Command, based in Colorado, oversees about 40,000 men and women, along with a host of U.S. military satellites. Other branches of the military also have smaller space efforts. Now, the White House's effort comes in response to advances by China, Russia, and other countries in space. It also raises the question as to whether or not the move might accelerate the militarization of space. Now, on this edition of Global Journalist, a look at how militaries have and could operate outside our atmosphere and what that may mean for the future of warfare. Now, in a few minutes, we're going to hear from some experts overseas to get an international perspective on this issue. But first, we're joined by two guests who track this issue closely here in the U.S. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is Todd Harrison. He's the director of the Aerospace Security Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Todd, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us across the Potomac in Alexandria, Virginia, is Sandra Irwin. She's a staff writer for Space News, a news organization that covers the business and politics of the space industry. Sandra, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure. Sandra, if you could start out just by telling us briefly, give us an overview of how the U.S. military uses space right now.
Yes. The U.S. military is very, very much dependent on space for just about everything. For communications, for navigation, positioning, timing, the targeting of weapons, weather. There is hardly any mission that you can think of that is not space dependent. So I think that increasing dependence, which has gone up over time, has made the military more concerned about the possibility that other countries are trying to build up their own capabilities in space and potentially could deny the U.S. military the capability to maneuver or to access space. And I think that's kind of how we got here to the point where the administration is saying that there has to be a space force because assets are too valuable and the Chinese are now able to launch satellites into high orbits. So it's game on. It's either take a stronger posture.
So, in other words, it sounds like the impetus is this, is that primarily the U.S. assets are satellites that are providing surveillance, communications, intelligence to ground-based forces. There aren't weapons in outer space that we know of that are meant to attack the Earth.
That is correct, Jason. And I think we have to understand that space technologies are, for the most part, dual use. All the space systems that we send up to orbit can be used for civilian or military purposes. So anything, potentially even a satellite that you send up to space to inspect other satellites, which is could be something perfectly legitimate, a maintenance mission or a surveillance mission, could be misinterpreted as a hostile attack. So that's where things get very confusing, and it's very important to have maybe some more precise rules so that people can understand that not every activity in space potentially would have a nefarious intent or it's a military operation. So that's why things are very confusing.
Let me hold this point because I think it's something we want to come back to. Todd Harrison, if I could bring you into the discussion, what would a space war look like or a conflict if one happened today?
Well, so it depends on how the conflict unfolds, but there are a variety of different counter space weapons that adversaries have developed and are fielding and could use in a conflict. So, of course, there are the kinetic weapons, direct ascent ASAT weapons like missiles that can launch and blow up a satellite in orbit. There's also a thing called co-orbital satellites. Russia has been experimenting a lot with these recently. China has as well. It's one satellite can go maneuver into another satellite and damage it or disable it somehow. But I'm actually not as worried about those threats because those are things that we can see. Those are things that we can attribute to others. Those are things that could possibly be deterred. What I'm more worried about are the invisible threats. So things like jamming of satellite communication signals. If we can't communicate with our satellites, they're as good as dead to us. things like directed energy weapons, like lasers that can blind or dazzle the sensors on a satellite. If the sensors stop working, then, you know, the satellite's no good to us. It's a mission kill. There's cyber attacks that can go in, and if they're successful, they can infiltrate the command and control link of a satellite and potentially take control of it and damage it or disable it somehow. So there's a whole host of threats. So the way that a space war would play out, it could be entirely silent. It could be invisible to the layperson on the ground.
Well, Sandra, you heard Todd talking about the different ways that satellites could be threatened. They could be shot by a missile, by a laser weapon, by cyber attacks, by jamming their communications. What do we know about the capacity of various militaries to do these types of activities?
Well, we only know from open source information. Actually, Todd's think tank, CSIS, has put out a study detailing some of those capabilities. Other think tanks also have put out some information. A lot of the threat information is classified, so we don't necessarily know, but we heard in testimony from military officials that they do believe that China would be the number one adversary in space right now because they are moving so fast in developing rockets and developing satellites. They are also pushing investments in their commercial sector. So,
and several years ago, China, correct me if I'm wrong, they actually shot down one of their own satellites with a missile that sort of like a test of the anti-satellite missile.
That is correct, Jason, and that was a big turning point. That was a wake-up call for the U.S. military. They saw the capability of China to be able to shoot down a satellite. Also, I believe it was in 2013 that they were able to launch a payload into geosynchronous Earth orbit, which is the orbit that the U.S. military has considered a sanctuary orbit where they think they are safe, but not anymore. Now it's potentially a contested area of space, so that is a very much a big concern for the Pentagon right now.
And Todd Harrison, what do we know? Have there been any other sort of weapons tests, if you will, of anti-satellite technologies that we're aware of?
Yeah, I mean, it's not just a matter of testing anymore. They're actually being used in real world. So Iran has been jamming different satellite signals when there are various broadcasts going into Iran, like Voice of America and BBC, that they're not happy with. They jam the signals. So that's a satellite attack. We see Russia, they have deployed a plane. It's called an A-60. It's been adapted with a laser on the top of the plane. And the clear intent of that plane, if you look at the insignia on the side of it, has a picture of a bird and then a lightning bolt going up from the bird into a satellite. This is a plane that is designed and built.
So they're not trying to mask what they're doing.
They're not masking it. It's designed to blind imaging satellites. We see China conducting, as Sandra said, it's not just the 2007 test that produced a lot of debris in orbit. China has continued to conduct ASAT tests. The only difference since 2007 is they've been conducting non-destructive tests since then. So instead of hitting a satellite in orbit, they just aim at a point to test their
Because that 2007 missile test, when they blew up one of their own satellites, it actually caused kind of a big problem because so much debris was spread out.
It did. It created thousands of pieces of debris that linger until today. And so other satellites have to maneuver. Even the International Space Station has had to maneuver to avoid some of the debris from the Chinese test back in 2007.
Well, Sandra, we heard about some of these new technologies that are coming online. I understand the U.S. Air Force has also been testing for several years an unmanned space plane. I think it's called the X-37 that's sort of launched on a rocket like the space shuttle. What do we know about what that plane does and what it's doing up in space?
Well, they've been flying this plane for about 5 years. This has been a long-term goal of the military is to be able to have access, easy access to space. And they view this plane as a platform to be able to get up into orbit really quickly. And say hypothetically, if some of the U.S. satellites were attacked or were blinded by lasers or any situation like that, they would be able to send small satellites with this space plane and deploy them really quickly. So the rapid access to space is a major goal that the military has had for a long time. So this is one of the platforms that they consider a vehicle to do that.
Well, Todd Harrison, what can you tell us about other kinds of space weapons that are maybe under development right now?
Yeah, well, on the U.S. side, this is all very highly classified. One thing that has been declassified in recent years are these small satellites in geostationary orbit called GSAP. And what they're used for is inspection of other satellites. So we want to keep an eye on what other countries are doing. And we've seen some suspicious things that Russia and China in particular have been doing. And so these GSAP inspector satellites, they can drift around geostationary orbit, and they can get close and they can sense and detect what these other systems are doing. The reason it was declassified is that we want other countries to know that we can see what they're doing so that we can help deter some bad actions.
And, well, Todd, just speculating here, if one of those satellites were to find that another satellite had been attacked, what sort of response would that generate? Is attacking another country's satellite, would that be considered an act of war in the same way blowing up a Jeep full of soldiers would be on the ground? What are some of the considerations here?
That's the key question. We don't have a lot of precedents in this area. There aren't norms of behavior in space that are well established and well accepted by the international community. So it's still kind of the Wild West. And so we're making this up as we go, trying to figure out what is a hostile act, what's a threatening act, how do you respond, what's a proportionate response. So, you know, for example, if someone destroys one of our satellites in orbit, of course, all of our military satellites are unmanned. So they destroy a satellite, no person was harmed, but it may be a very important military capability. What's a proportionate response for us to take? Could we blow up something on the ground and potentially take the lives of people in this, you know, adversary state? We haven't really worked out all of these rules yet, and we don't have clear rules of engagement and clear understandings, with our allies in particular, about what constitutes an act of war in space.
Well, Sandra Irwin, our time does grow short, but I did want to ask you about the significance of this proposed Space Force that the White House has called for, but it's by no means clear that Congress will authorize this reorganization of the military. What do you make of this and the significance of it?
Well, there's a number of issues here. First, it is very much a political issue right now. This is an initiative that the Trump administration feels very strongly about. They want to get it through. This is going to be part of the Trump legacy. So they are going to be very forceful in trying to work with Congress to make it happen. But it is far from a done deal. Congress has to approve funding. Not everyone is on board. We saw a poll this morning that 68% of Republicans approve of the Space Force. 69% of Democrats do not approve of the Space Force. So it's become another partisan issue in Washington. So that is going to make it very interesting. There's also financial issues. We don't know how much it's going to cost. The Pentagon has a big budget, but they also have so many other priorities that it's difficult to see, you know, how much money are they going to be able to afford to pay for the Space Force. So there's that. And then, of course, you know, the whole, you know, getting through a very complicated legal process, because it took 5 years to create U.S. Special Operations Command. And that was not even a separate service, that was just a command. So imagine if you're trying to create a new service with the amount of legislation and negotiation that is required. So we're in for a long haul here trying to see how this goes.
Well, Sandra Irwin, Todd Harrison, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A reminder that you're tuned into Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, we're talking about the militarization of space. There's renewed interest in the potential for a space arms race following the Trump administration's announcement that it intends to create a space force as a fifth branch of the U.S. military. Now, if you're interested in more Global Journalist, check us out online at globaljournalist.org. There you can find our archives and additional coverage of underreported international news and human rights issues. You can also like us on Facebook, where we live stream, follow us on Twitter, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, or see our video cast on YouTube. And we just heard from Todd Harrison of the Center for Strategic and International Studies and Sandra Irwin of Space News. To expand our discussion, we're going to bring in two other people who have been following this issue. Joining us from Christchurch, New Zealand, is Maria Poza. She's a lawyer specializing in space law at the firm Govett Quilliam. Maria, welcome.
Thank you.
And with us from Canterbury, England, is Bengo Ndunten. He's an associate professor of international commercial law at the University of Kent. He also researches space law and policy there. Bengo, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, Maria, if I could start with you then. My understanding is that there are a number of treaties and agreements that countries have signed on to over time governing how the military should be used in space. But could you just break down maybe like the most important one or two aspects of this for us?
Sure. There's five major multilateral treaties that pertain to activities in outer space. Perhaps the most major treaty that we're talking about here is the Outer Space Treaty 1967, which has an arms control provision under Article 4, stipulating that state parties, such as the US, must not undertake to place in orbit nuclear weapons or weapons carrying mass destruction. Similarly, there is a prohibition on such state parties from conducting military maneuvers or establishing military bases, installations, and fortifications on the moon and other celestial bodies under that treaty.
Okay, so this is obviously 1967. It's signed at a time of tension between the U.S. and Soviet Union during the Cold War, during the space race then, in other words. That was sort of the driving impetus for this.
That's exactly right. Context is so specific and important when we contemplate international treaties and international legal obligations, especially when we're looking at outer space.
And if I could just pick up on that with you, Bengo Ndunten, you wrote an article recently arguing that President Trump's Space Force initiative should raise some serious alarms about how militaries have been used in space and how that may change. Tell us just a little bit about what you saw as problematic.
President Trump's Space Force idea has raised a lot of, concern in countries that you would expect, like China, like Russia. Specifically, Russia has mentioned that it sees the development as a provocation and that it would react, in quote, with a tough response. What that means, I don't want to find out, because I would rather have peace than tension in the international system, and certainly tension in the in international outer space. I don't think it's a positive development, and we have time to explore that.
And so, in other words, then, if I was understanding Maria correctly, and Bengo, if you could just pick up on this, it sounds like the treaties that govern how militaries operate in space is different from, say, the Antarctic Treaty, which is what quite clearly says the Antarctic is international and not to be militarized. Am I wrong in that?
Yes, the Antarctic Treaty and the Law of the Sea Convention, which are older bodies of law, have been very, they have set a wonderful and positive tone for international management of international space. The Law of the Sea Convention is based on the common heritage of mankind for the area, which is known as the area is the parts of the sea that fall under no jurisdiction of any particular state. And Antarctica also is a province of peace. These two areas, we don't have any problems there, specifically because we sat down and there was a massive treaty, the 1982 Law of the Sea Convention, which dealt with that, and also treaties governing Antarctica. I think those are wonderful, I would like to say, precedents that we should follow. And in fact, space law has followed them before they came into existence. So a lot of the things we see happening in space law now, or in space science as well, is really a restiveness on the part of states that have the technological capacity to upturn the cards. Space law was settled between 1962 and 1979, when the Moon Treaty was created, was quite settled on many of the things that we now pretend are up in the air. Outer space is a zone of peace. The Antarctica and the Law of the Sea are all zones of peace. What we do in practice is something else, but to pretend that the law is not there would be quite disingenuous, sorry to say.
Well, let me bring this back to you, Maria Poza, because you mentioned this 1967 Outer Space Treaty. That treaty was signed at a time when both the U.S. and the Soviet Union had ballistic missiles that traveled through space and could actually shoot, correct me if I'm wrong, different nuclear warheads off at different targets as it traveled. And I think there was, correct me if I remember, there was even a time when we were testing bombs in outer space. And so this treaty, tell us just a little bit more about sort of the context that left us with the law we have.
Sure. Look, first of all, I think we need to be clear. We're not talking about the militarization or non-militarization of outer space. Space has already been militarized. During the 60s, when the Outer Space Treaty was contemplated by states parties at the international level, there was a space race, and it was the military wings of our superpowers of that time, the former Soviet Union and the US, that developed space technology, undertook space research and design. So when we think about it in that context, we simply can't devolve militarization from space. It has already been militarized. And when we consider the testing of weapons, certainly in 1962, the US tested the Starfish Prime, which was part of the fishbowl testing. And under that testing, a nuclear weapon was detonated in outer space, perhaps somewhere along the region of 1,445 kilometers from the Earth. And as a result of that fallout, almost a second Van Allen belt was created, and Hawaii certainly suffered a lot of interference. Burglar alarms went off, telephone companies went down. This is all part of the context. And when we look at the Outer Space Treaty, the prohibition of carrying nuclear weapons in outer space under Article 4 has been something that is underlined by a security implication. During the 60s, it was a great fear after nuclear testing in outer space, and especially by the results of Starfish Prime, that if space exploration couldn't occur, if human space exploration couldn't occur because of nuclear fallout, this was really going to dampen a lot in the way of research and development.
So in other words, because we were at that time launching these massive hydrogen bombs into space to test them, and I believe the Soviet Union did this as well, it was actually making space a rather unpleasant place to explore then, or difficult.
Certainly. You would have to create a whole series of new technologies in order to safeguard humans who were then going into space for exploration purposes if there was a lot of nuclear fallout. And how would you protect your space assets that cost millions and nearly billions of dollars to get into outer space? They wouldn't be able to function properly in that environment. So there was an agreement by the former Soviet Union and the US that space should not be used for nuclear weapons testing. And that's reflected in the treaty.
Well, Mbengo Odutan, if I could turn this back to you then as well, what do you see as some potential solutions now to how the U.S., Russia, China, I mean, you mentioned that it's really just a handful of countries that are especially active in space. What sort of framework do you suggest for regulating how militaries operate in space?
Well, I think the first thing to recognize is that I don't see it as a settled that space militarization is inevitable. Yes, there is a bit of a lacuna. There's a bit of a space, if you permit the pun, in the law, which allows states to have some kind of weaponization as long as it is not the use of nuclear weapons, as long as it's not the use of weapons of mass destruction. Yes, that's a valid way of looking at the situation. However, if we look at a purposive interpretation of the law, if we look at what the purpose of space law is, it is to preserve outer space as a zone of peace. I'm very happy that Maria mentioned the 1967 Space Treaty and its good jurisprudence in the area of maintaining outer space as a peaceful zone. It says that the exploration and use of space shall be carried out for the benefit of all states and shall be the province of mankind. It says that outer space shall be for exploration and use by all states and is free from appropriation. It should be used for peaceful purposes. If you look at all these provisions and take them into consideration in a holistic manner, I think it becomes very difficult to argue for an inevitable militarization of outer space. Lastly, I would like to actually mention the possibility of having the Paris Treaty. This is a peaceful a treaty that is going through the parliaments now, going through the Committee for Disarmament now, proposed prevention of an arms race in space treaty. This treaty is one which I think we can lay a lot of hope in ironing out the rough edges of the law and closing the gap. Unfortunately, the United States has single-handedly been the main Achilles heel of this proposed treaty. Every country, including the European Union, including China, including Russia, have said that they would rather...
The U.S. no doubt is the largest player in space, sees it as an effort by other countries to try to constrain its defense capabilities. Is that not the case?
It does have the right to do so. But what I'm trying to point out is that this is a treaty that offers us an avenue to close the gap. And I think we should be looking to closing the gap, because outer space militarization is a battle that no one state can win. You mentioned the blowing up of a Chinese satellite and the fragments that it brought into the outer space, and the one single flick of a paint thickness of debris in outer space can destroy a spacecraft, can destroy another satellite. So I think the best way is to prevent this happening entirely. No one can win space militarization. It takes just one state to blow up several...
I'm sorry, Bengar, our time grows short. I want to give the last word to Maria Poza here. Where do you see things moving over the next 3 years, 5 years? What changes can we expect in sort of how conflict is managed in space?
When we're dealing with space and we're looking at international law and international global security, I think it's always important to take into account that states will do what it is necessary to defend themselves and in the climate of national security that they feel tension in. The US under President Trump's proposal for the Space Force isn't something that is necessarily illegal in outer space. In fact, the international law pertaining to outer space activities doesn't really categorically say that space is reserved only for peaceful purposes. States can utilize outer space as long as they're utilizing it in a way that is conducive to the good of mankind. So that could include scientific research.
That's open to interpretation then, the good of mankind then.
Sure. So as an area of res communis, for example, as Bengar was pointing out, when we think of Antarctica, law of the sea, these are areas of res communis, an area that belongs to no one but is for everyone. Outer space is the same. So how do we implement control measures and procedures in order to try and stop other states from doing certain things that may cause an insecurity at the global level?
Maria, I'm sorry, we're just out of time. We're going to have to leave it there for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Todd Harrison, Sandra Irwin, Maria Poza, and Bengo Duntan. Our producers this week are Yan Chi Su and Rosie Belson. Aaron Hay is audio engineer. Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.